first of all, welcome everybody, and Joe, thank you again so much for joining us. You know, I don't know how many of these you've done for us. It's probably 5, 6, 7 already, and I know you're very busy with your teaching schedule and your busy practice, so it's always very much appreciated for you to join us to do these.
Well, thank you, Kim. It's a wonderful thing, and you know, occasionally I do get emails and of appreciation or questions. And just to let everybody know, I very much welcome any questions or comments. It's really a wonderful, warm thing to be able to connect with members of our community, people who want to help me learn better or help me teach better. And I'm always very appreciative of that. And I also want to say thank you to you, Kim. You know, this service you have rendered to the homeopathic community needs to be acknowledged. I mean, your dedication to a high level of education and an open door to self-improvement in this community is truly unparalleled, and I have to thank you for that,
well,
for your commitment
nice
to that.
You know, when it comes to working with people like yourself who really, you know, maintain such a high standard of integrity relative to your teaching and practice, it's really just a total joy for me. So, you know, it's mutual. So for those of you who are not already familiar with Dr. Kellerstein, let me just provide a quick introduction. Dr. Kellerstein graduated from the University of Toronto in 1976 with a special interest in physiology and zoology. He then received his chiropractic degree in 1980 and his naturopathic degree in 1984. He subsequently graduated from the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy in 1991. That's the school associated with Dr. Andre Sain, who's been one of Dr. Kellerstein's foremost mentors. And he's been in practice, Joe's been in practice since 1983, providing both chiropractic and homeopathic care. Dr. Kellerstein has a special interest in neurolinguistic programming and its application to homeopathic case-taking. Currently, Dr. Kellerstein lectures at the homeopathy, the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy. That's again the school associated with Dr. Andre Sain, and he's one of the core faculty at what used to be called the Toronto School of Homeopathic Medicine, which has recently changed their name to the Canadian College of Homeopathic Medicine. And the school is now ushering a whole new era in. If you want more information about that school, you can visit their website, which is www.homeopathycanada.com. Again, that's www.homeopathycanada.com. Now, aside from what I just said here, you know, which is just basic facts that I'm reading off a page, let me just say that Dr. Kellerstein is one of the best homeopathic prescribers that I know of and an incredibly gifted educator. He is somebody who really enters into a Socratic dialogue with his students, and you can tell that not only is he a master of this great science and art, which we call homeopathy, but he's able to, in himself, impart to his students the ability for them to practice on their own. In other words, he creates a situation where homeopathy actually becomes reproducible. And for me, this is really the key because, you know, somebody could be a master homeopathic practitioner and stand up there and wow you and be the great guru, but if he can't impart that knowledge and make it so that you can actually duplicate his success in your own practice, then really how will homeopathy really spread and grow across this planet? So I have to really acknowledge and recognize Dr. Kellerstein for this amazing gift and his ability to really spread the good word about what homeopathy is capable of doing. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Kellerstein will be one of the many presenters at this year's Joint American Homeopathic Conference in Alexandria, Virginia, which will be running from April 8th through the 10th. It's going to be an amazing conference. Will be the probably biggest and most important conference in North America this year. The lineup of speakers is essentially some of the most well-known and best practitioners on the planet, including people like George Patolkas, Jeremy Scher, Alistair Gray, Farouk Master, Will Taylor, Dr. Joe Kellerstein, Miranda Castro, Annette Snivellet, Anna Vivacka, Massimo Mangiovori. So these are some of the best known names in our community. And aside from each of these individuals giving a very dynamic, incredible lecture with videos and case follow-ups, In addition, there'll be the unveiling of the Global Homeopathy video, which is actually documenting the power that homeopathy is having to change people's lives across the planet. There will also be a dialogue between all of the speakers where they'll have an opportunity to discuss amongst each other the classical approaches versus the new approaches and have a real informative discussion about the place of each of these different ideas in contemporary homeopathic practice. So again, that's going to be April 8th through the 10th in Alexandria, Virginia. If there's any way you can make it to that conference, I can't recommend it highly enough. If you want more information about it, you can go to the NCH website, which is www.homeopathic, that's homeopathic.org, and you go there, you'll see all of the speakers and their talks and other things that will be going on during that event. So again, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a great pleasure.
Thank you, Kim.
So, Joe, I know that you had wanted to simply talk about some of the cases that you've had over the years that have been very instructive in your own development as a homeopath and that address certain issues in practice that you thought might be very relevant and useful for some of the participants on tonight's call. So perhaps we could just start with that, and you could go ahead and go through some of these cases, and we can go through discussing them and a little later on open it up for some questions.
Yeah, you know, I found that in practice, some of the cases I've been fortunate enough to help and have had a certain – the cases that I've had the ability to see with a certain view of logic, according to the Organon, I think, and later reflect on, have had many teaching points for me, and I wanted to share those. And sometimes I find that when I share these cases with other people, it raises questions in them that are in turn important elements of instruction for us all. You know, the basic phenomenon of homeopathic practice is that we are confronted with a morass of information. Often we're bewildered, sometimes we're overwhelmed, confused. Then the question is how to create distinctions, how to cut into that huge cake of information so as to sculpt out a path that will lead us towards the prescription of a medicine with confidence. And this is my quest because it's what we do every day. We have to be effective as doctors on a daily basis. And that's our true test, not the randomized controlled trial, but our patients. Are we successful with our patients? Homeopathy has always survived by grassroots success. So these first cases are, admittedly, they're abbreviated cases, but because of the format of that we're having tonight is a teleconference on the telephone without the advantage of computers, I've abbreviated certain cases so that it's easier for people to think about and to think about the key points of, because in the end, it's only a few key points that we retain. The lessons that these cases have for me are extremely valuable. And not only are the lessons of the cases and their analyses valuable, but it's also instructive as to the reaction that I got from participants where I have already presented these cases. So, Kim, if it's okay, I'd like to go ahead and start. Is that all right with people?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Now, the first case is just labeled Mr. C. Now, please imagine in your mind this gentleman. This gentleman was approximately 45 years old, a businessman, in fact, more specifically, an accountant, the archetypal accountant. You know, he's a lovely gentleman, very friendly, very accurate, very open, very succinct. And he has this, just the shape of his body is something that struck me as a practitioner, a very nice round head, sitting on a moderately rotund body, slightly overweight, very pleasant individual, a 45-year-old businessman. Now, a year ago, now when I wrote this, it was several years ago already, he had taken a recreational program at a local Y in order to learn kayaking. The instruction took place in the swimming pool of the Y, so it was chlorinated. And as one of the training exercises for the kayaking, there was this required, I don't know how to put it, a required effort to turn the craft upside down while sitting in it so as to be able to right it later on. So he had to turn it upside down, hold his breath for a few seconds before righting himself. Now, in the process of, I guess it's called trimming, his timing was a bit off. And to quote the gentleman, he had sucked up a nose full of chlorinated water. The response to this on his nasal mucous membranes was that he felt this immediate and severe irritation of the nasal membranes, like something that smarted him, and it passed maybe about 4 or 5 minutes later. But since that time, since that single episode, he's not been the same. He suffered an irritating congestion that's there most of the time, as he describes at his initial. Now, I took this initial while I was doing a clinic, so it was on closed-circuit TV with about 30, 40 students watching.
Bill, can I interrupt you for a second? There's kind of a wobbliness to your voice, and it kind of cuts in and out a little bit. I don't know if there's anything you can do about that. But
Perhaps if I hold the phone closer, is this better, or is that better, Kim?
No, it almost sounds like it's like just like the line is cutting out a little bit every time you're speaking.
Should I try calling back again or change location in the house?
Well, why don't we just go on a little bit more, and if it continues to be a problem, I'll stop you again.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, he's not felt his usual self since all of this. Now, he suffers, as I said, an irritating nasal congestion. With the congestion, his head always hurts. This is how he summarized it. This is how he told it to me initially. He's not been his usual self since all of this. His stamina is less. And here we have the situation. This is all he can say. Now, how many of you have faced a situation in practice where you get something like this that doesn't seem at all appropriate to a repertory, appropriate to homeopathic symptomatology, and the patient seems stuck, you seem stuck, and it feels like, oh my God, what do I do now? Well, I use some questioning techniques we can talk about later, but I use some of these very close, persistent questioning techniques to extract just a few more facts. And what I got was this. With the headache, I get a heat in my forehead and a heaviness deep in the ears. The quotation, you know, this quotation has something that seems interesting in the way of information. But what exactly is it? So on reflection, okay, so again, with the headache, I get heat in the forehead and a heaviness deep in the ears. So how do I look at this? How do I research such a thing? If we look at it, we have two phenomena: heat in the forehead and a heaviness deep in the ears. It's a concomitance, just as Boininghausen described. It's a concomitance. So how do we go ahead and research it? There are many, many varied entries under head pain in our repertories, and the synthesis, it's very, very rich. So maybe there's a possibility we can find something. So I turned to several repertories, and in addition, and since, you know, I really consult the synthesis, especially because of the concomitants that are right at the head of many of the rubrics. And I found this. So if we turn to the rubric, heat in the head, accompanied by, we see a rubric called heaviness. It's exactly what we need. But, you know, the question arises, can I use that legitimately? Because the heaviness was deep in the ears. So really what I'd like is something that says heat in the head with heaviness deep in the ears. But wait a minute. Heaviness deep in the ears is, in fact, in the head. I mean, we can't avoid that the ears are in the head. Okay, so I can use this, I think. So heat in the head accompanied by heaviness in the ears. We have three entries in the synthesis repertory. So if we look at that, I'm looking at a screenshot of Radar Opus with that particular rubric, and we have three remedies: Calcarea, Herudino, and Metarhinum. It's interesting. That concomitance immediately gives us an unparalleled specificity, a uniqueness. So I said, okay, what can I do with this? Well, the challenge now is, can I substantiate this in the rest of the case? But this is kind of what Hahnemann, or Pierre Schmidt more accurately, I think, would have called a defective case. So the idea is, normally a case expresses itself in a unique manner that is available on relatively casual, inobtrusive questioning, but not in this case. So we need to be a little bit more forceful, but yet we cannot ask direct questions. So I used, again, certain question techniques to try to see, can I substantiate any of these remedies? And really, to my surprise, after just a bit of questioning, I find that this individual with the low stamina, so questions like, when you are very low in energy, when exactly are you especially low in energy? He ultimately did come up with an answer. You know, on reflection, he said, you know, I am worse around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That seems to be, and I questioned to see whether or not that was reliable. Did it transcend work days and go to the weekends? And it did. So right away, I'm focusing in on a particular remedy that I think many of you can already see. But I needed to substantiate it further, because we need to see that a totality of symptoms are satisfied by looking at a particular remedy. And I found out that when he is in this weakened state, with very slight exertion, he will sweat profusely, even though he had not really come to that conclusion. A little bit of questioning did. So we have these symptoms: heaviness and heat in the head. We have the worsening at 2 p.m. and a remedy that is clearly aggravated by easy perspiration on slight exertion. We have a fantastic confirmation of calcarb. So calcarb was given, but not before I could confirm it with original sources. Because as good as a repertory might be, the repertory only tells us which remedy to go back and study in the original sources first. It doesn't tell us what to prescribe. It can't. Because a repertory sacrifices completeness for space. We have to understand that unless we go back to original sources, Hahnemann, Herring, Allen, to confirm what we're actually thinking the repertory says, we're not sure. So I did that. I went back, and I noticed that in Allen's encyclopedia, we have a quote under calcarb: heaviness in the head in the morning on waking for several hours. Okay. Heaviness in the head in the morning on waking with heat in it. Both are aggravated on moving the head and raising it. Okay, so we have the concomitance here of heaviness and heat. So then I turn to Herring's guiding symptoms. Now, the difference clinically between Allen's Encyclopedia and Herring's Guiding Symptoms is especially this. Allen's Encyclopedia is more a depository, a fullness of proving symptoms. Now, it has some clinical additions, but in the main, it is purely proving symptoms, whereas Herring said we need more than this. We also need to know when a remedy is proven, that is more or less its birth. That's an idea that I just quoted from Andre. So the proving of a remedy is more or less its birth. When more and more clinical cases are cured and reported with precision, we see how that remedy plays out in more and more advanced and finally end-stage pathological conditions. So that's the maturation of a remedy. Now, Herring understood this. Herring wanted a book that showed and reflected this aspect. Which symptoms of the proving are confirmed again and again in clinical cases, and how does the remedy look as it cures end-stage condition? So that's the difference between Allen's Encyclopedia and Herring's Guiding Symptoms. So as an example of that, look at what I found. I've already stated what I found in Allen's Encyclopedia, but I also wanted to see what Herring had to say about it. And listen to this, just a beautiful, terse sentence. Head feels hot, dull, and heavy in coryza. Period. Those few words, tersely and exactly pointed out by Herring, in a cured case of coryza, which can include a sinusitis, precisely defines our case. So I gave Calcarb 200, followed in about 3 weeks because of a mild relapse, a 1M, and we've got a cure. Very straightforward, based on a very clear, and here's a new word, a very clear genius of the case. A very clear genius of the case. Now, the genius of the case has been phrased in many ways. It can be the minimum number of symptoms of maximum peculiar or characteristic value. But in this case, the concomitants, heat in the head with a heaviness, that was the genius. The confirmatory was found in the rest of the case, the easy perspiration and the 2 p.m. gave us a kind of precision and confidence in the prescription that is really almost beyond question. So the genius of the case can often be explained in a very precise manner, maybe one symptom, two or three, but it does require support from the rest of the case because we have to use the totality according to Hahnemann. And I wanted to show in this case that there's incredible value in seeing concomitant symptoms and a very rich representation of those concomitants in the accompanied by aspect of the rubrics and the synthesis that Frederick Schroyens especially did for that purpose. My next teaching point in this particular case is the value of using entries both in Allen's Encyclopedia and in Herring's Guiding Symptoms to see the precision and the difference and to give you confidence in prescription to know that you're doing it accurately. Okay. Kim, any questions about that from you?
Yeah, actually, I do have a couple of questions. You know, I've heard you actually give this kind of presentation before and actually present these particular cases. And I guess my first question is, I know that one of the issues here is really sometimes the patient will not bring forward the symptom in such a precise and clear way as is necessary to be able to find the appropriate rubric or even the corresponding symptom in the materia medica. I think that if I'm correct, it's, I think it's aphorism 95 where Hahnemann discusses the issue of the patient having been so accustomed to his defilements or his disease state that he kind of forgets the condition that he's in, and he just kind of thinks that that's the way he always is, and he just doesn't have any direct experience of it the way he did originally when he first experienced the symptom. It's just become part of his own overall experience of life. And you have given some really interesting examples. I remember one that you gave is the one of the patient who comes in and says, you know, I have a pain in my leg when I go to sleep. And so then, you know, that's the symptom. And if you just assume that that's the correct symptom and you write that down, you know, and then you look at that corresponding rubric in the repertoire, you may not actually have the right symptom. And then you go on to give examples of how you actually question the patient. And if you further question it, you say, well, exactly where is that pain? And when he points, it's not in the leg, it's actually in the buttocks. And then you say, well, is it always when you go to sleep, or is it anytime? And he says, oh, well, it's anytime I lay down. And you say, well, is it when you lay down in any position? Or he says, no, specifically when I lay down on my right side. And so then the symptom changes from, you know, pain in my leg when I go to sleep at night to pain in my buttocks when I lie down on my right side. And to me, this is a very important and critical issue because oftentimes we don't delve deeply enough into the case to be able to elucidate and create this very clear symptom that will allow us to find the best remedy choice from the list of available medicines. So I was wondering if you could give just a couple of examples of the type of questions that you ask that help to clarify the symptoms that the patient is presenting.
Well, you know, that's a fantastic thing. May I digress to tell you a historical story?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So as a very beginning, not a very beginning practitioner, I think I was probably about in practice 3-4 years. I was fortunate enough to get a slew of patients all in a row.
Joe, right now it's very wobbly. I don't know if you can move to a different location or if you did something different, but it's been intermittent, but right now it's really bad.
You know what? Let me see if it makes a difference if I move rooms, Kim. Hold on.
Okay. Sorry about that, Joe.
That's okay. Kim, does it make a difference out here?
Yeah, that sounds better.
Okay, so let me use this. This is better?
Yeah, I think it is better, yeah.
Okay. So a number of years ago, when I got a series of patients all suffering depression, I ran into a roadblock that I think all of us do when we start to take cases. The situation was this. I had a patient with depression. Now imagine somebody suffering a severe depression with a dour expression, the furrowed brow, downturn sitting in front of you. And I would say, tell me about depression. And the patient just looked at me and said, I'm depressed. I'm sad. What do you want from me? And at that point, you know, your heart falls down and you say, oh my God, what do I do? But I need to get from that expression, which has no value to me at all, right?
Absolutely.
Because how many remedies, 600 remedies in the rubric sadness, how do I get from there to something more valuable? And I was stumped. I was stumped. And the patient saw this. And the more they saw this, the less information they would give me, and I felt like a failure. I wanted to learn how to build a house or something. I don't know. Anyway, I went to my teacher of the time, Andre, and I said, you know, I have this problem. To get repertorially appropriate symptomatology, something I can work with, when the patient is only giving me these big words, these generalizations. And he said, Joe, take it easy. Try this question. So he said, when you say depression, what do you mean? And I thought, isn't that fascinating? So I road tested it. I went back the next Monday after this seminar, and on everybody I met, whatever they said, I said, when you say blank, what do you mean? And I would get these wonderful, rich expressions of experience. And suddenly my prescribing leaped on the basis of one question. So I said, well, this is good stuff. I like this. It wasn't long later when a friend of mine said, you know, if you like that kind of stuff, Joe, I've been taking a course called NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, where the developers of this system of psychology, Bandler and Grinder, have encountered a similar problem. And what they do is they have a series of questions called a meta model. Now, 13 questions, and you can Google this and find it everywhere. 13 questions whose function it is, and listen to the way they put it, people will often generalize their experience. People will often generalize their experience more and more over time. So let's use this as an example. Let's say we have an individual who's gotten upset, let's say pissed off, and the person has gotten so upset that they feel, I want to stab that person in the chest with a knife. And this is the instant thought. By the time a week elapses, that specific experience becomes, man, was I angry. Within a few weeks, when he goes to his doctor and tells him, you know, he doesn't say that. He says, I was kind of upset. And that's probably the way he'll express it to a homeopath. The challenge of the homeopath becomes, I have to get from this generalization and distortion of the original experience back to the adjectivally rich and specific experience he had in the first place, the primary experience. Now, Bandler and Grinder in NLP have devised a series of questions that when you master them, you can get from the present to the original. And isn't that the same as approving? I was blown away. Approving is a primary experience. And the prover is trained to write down what he experiences in a very rich, descriptive, but concise manner. So we need to get from that generalization, which occurs over time, back to the descriptor, rich experience through skilled questioning. Well, I was hooked. I was hooked. I studied NLP starting in 1992. And I got more and more qualifications, and I really had no interest in using it in a therapeutic or psychologic manner. My interest was in homeopathy. So with every education, with every level of learning, I tried to see how can I apply this to homeopathic case taking. Until recently, where I've devised and developed a small course, a couple of weekends, where I actually coach the essentials.
Joe, are you still there? We're not hearing you. Joe? Hello?
That has been horrible.
Can other people hear me?
Yeah.
But we lost Joe. So I don't know, his phone seems to have cut out, and hopefully he knows that, and it's not just talking to empty space, and we'll...
Tim?
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah, how is this?
Yeah, no, that's good. You cut out completely for a moment there, but that sounds great. Okay, good.
Okay,
good. I'm sorry, you can go ahead and continue then.
Sure. So the issue became my fascination with accessing the primary experience of the patient. Because as time goes on, as Hahnemann says, it becomes discarded, covered over, and generalized. So I have researched and tried to educate myself in questioning methodologies so as to re-access that primary experience of the patient. And recently, I experimented with it. I decided to create a two-weekend program on coaching the essential skills of case taking. Now, weekend one was where I used a model very similar to that of Andre Sain when he teaches speaking, to use all the questioning techniques to be complete in questioning the patient. But weekend two was the development of questioning skills to help re-access that primary experience of the patient, one that would more mimic approving. And to have people do it then and there so that I could help advance their experience and correct their technique. And it's been very, you know, it was very successful. I was very, very pleased. And then I thought, you know, social workers are coached in how to do an interview. Why haven't homeopaths been actively coached in case-taking skills? If you can't take a case, if you cannot access information that looks like the symptoms of approving, that looks like the keynotes of a remedy, how can you ever associate to a remedy? And if you can't associate to a remedy, you become a prey to people who would have you use other than homeopathic methodologies to arrive at a remedy, which is okay, but really, as homeopaths, it first behooves us to learn those skills basic to homeopathy. You still with me?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe, and that's absolutely a very wonderfully concise explanation of a most critical aspect of homeopathic practice, no question about it. I hope people appreciate what Joe just communicated there, because really fundamentally, as he just stated, if you can't elicit clear symptoms, of arriving at a good remedy prescription is very, very difficult and sometimes completely impossible. So,
we're forced to do an end run. To me, a lot of techniques that exist in homeopathy today in the popular seminar field are there because people are looking for ways around essential difficulties in practice. And that shouldn't be. It all speaks to a basic flaw in our essential education. You know, I think we have some fantastic geniuses that are teaching wonderful creative methods that can augment, in many ways, our ability to prescribe. But my focus is this. We need excellence at basics. In homeopathic skills, we need to know our organon in a way that resembles reality. We need to take a case so that the outcome of our case resembles approving. And we need to be able to analyze in a way that is consistent with the fantastic, rich resources we have. Say, for example, present in Encyclopedia Homeopathica, now in Radar Opus, of the literature we have in the IHA, the Recorder, the Homeopathician, all of the Organa, all these wonderful old journals that show us how to be homeopaths.
That's great, Joe. Joe, I know you have one more case that you wanted to present, and I can see we're running short on time. Do you want to just...
Sure, let's go for it.
Yeah, let's do it so we can get through that case as well.
Absolutely. This is a case of a gentleman who I've been treating. I call him Mr. S. He was 80 years old at the time. So imagine a gentleman tall and thin with a frail look about him, white hair, and a kind of skin that looks very smooth and well cared for, almost as if he had polished it or used some sort of oil on it. He had a history of working for General Motors as a salesperson. And then he quickly ascended the ranks because of his charm. He's a lovely, lovely man. He had been under my care intermittently for about 3 years. He was a man completely devoted and madly in love with his ailing wife of 40 years. The last 6 years, she had been suffering Alzheimer's. She recently passed away. While he was nursing her,
his loving daughter had brought him, schlepped him right in for treatment, and he'd responded well to natrum urinignatia. Recently, his wife had passed away. The present complaints, the ones he comes with now, are a little puzzling to me. They consist primarily of memory loss, confusion, and, quote, a kind of vertigo that he says is not really dizzy. He doesn't understand it. So I question him more about it. This last feeling impairs his confidence in being out walking. His family physician had diagnosed early stage dementia, which is so tragic. I mean, his wife had just died. He had gone through all of that with her, and now he is suffering it. Once again, you know, characterizing this, quote, feeling that is not, this dizziness that is not dizzy, was very difficult. But ultimately, he did express it very clearly as a metaphor. And he labeled this metaphor. He said, it feels as if there is air in my head. Okay. So on consulting the Materia Medica, I tried to further clarify, but that was the end of the road. No temperature or pressure sensations, no sensation of movement of this air. He insisted that it was simply as stated, as if there was air in my head. Okay, so, you know, one of the first things I want to say here is that when we get a physical sensation that is an as-if, it is often very characteristic and peculiar, as opposed to a mental sensation that may or may not be. But a physical sensation is often, often extremely important in the analysis of the case. And this was one of the key features that was important here. So I looked to see if there was a rubric in the synthesis. And certainly there was. There, in fact, there's more than one that I could find suspect here. The one rubric was a feeling, this is from Radar, the synthesis, head air filled with air as if head. So as if the head was filled with air, and we have three remedies, aurum, germanium, and lecithinum. Then we have another rubric, head air filled with as if passing through the head. So as if there were a current of air passing through the head. Now this is not what he said. In fact, he denied, but I thought, you know what? It depends on where the original editors of the repertory put their symptoms, because it's only a repository. It can't be with ultimate precision. We have to allow for some error. Now, a reading of the actual Materia Medica of the first three remedies under as if the head filled with air, which is where you would expect this would be, because he denied any, you know, as if there were pressure in my head with the air, as if there was a current of air. No, he denied that because I read it to him. He said, no, it's just like there's air in my head. But if you read those three root, if you read the root sources of those three remedies being there, they all had a sense of pressure or something that he denied, because he was right in front of me as I read him from the provings, those original rubrics. The only satisfying entry occurred in the following rubric, where it said as if air passing through the head, and it didn't happen until I was about, oh, let's say about 7 remedies down the line in that. Now, you wouldn't want to use that rubric, because he said he denied it felt as if it was passing through, but I still went there. But I found under one remedy, sensation as if there were air in the head. This was Allen's Encyclopedia. I thought, wow, okay, this is it. This is precisely what he said. So then I said, but wait a minute. It has to be in a context of something having to do with dementia, something having to do with vertigo. So I found under this same remedy, which happened to be benzoic acid, I found vertigo, making him fearful of falling sideways. So remember what he said. He said, lack confidence in going for a walk. And then this is what I found especially interesting, that under benzoic acid, there was this entry that said, tired feeling in the head as if from night watching. Now, night watching is a terminology used for people suffering the ill effects of caring for someone who is sick over a long period of time. He had years of caring for his wife. I call this kind of thing, when reviewing the source material, a pleasant surprise. The more of these little pleasant surprises that are unplanned you get when you read Herring or Allen, the greater the confidence in your prescription. Under benzoic acid, there was also sadness. There's also an entry saying he was much surprised that while writing, he omitted words every moment, which was never the case before. So to me, this validated the possibility of it being used in a state of memory loss or dementia. It doesn't say dementia, but this resembles dementia. I gave him benzoic acid 30, only because that was the highest potency I could get my hands on. The response, because it was an early stage dementia, the response was rapid and remarkable. This gentleman lived for about 2 to 3 more years and in great health. Unfortunately, he passed away. I don't know the cause later, but he did pass away. But I do know that his health was very good up until that point. So the points I wanted to make here was, number one, the value of a physical sensation when it is clearly and firmly expressed, when the patient can give you that definition, they're sitting right there for you. The next thing I wanted to say, the value of checking the symptoms in the materia medica for precision and not just relying on a rubric title. The repertory cannot be as accurate as the fullness of our literature. And we need to have a computer program with easy access to that fullness because we need precision. And I wanted to show you the technique here of actually checking for that while the patient was sitting there. So we have the genius of the case, the core of the case, again, the air in the head, but then we also need to confirm the rest of the case, the rest of the totality, with the proving or the clinically known symptoms, which I did. The memory loss, the ailments from night watching, from caring for the sick, and the vertigo. And then I wanted to show you again that often when we read our source material, the bonus we get is this pleasant surprise when it strikes us that we see something else of our original case in the thing we casually peruse. So that's the end of that case. Kim, any questions about...
Yeah, actually, I have one. I'd like to give some people on the call an opportunity to ask some questions as well, because I thought this has been a very interesting discussion. But I guess the one question I wanted to ask is, you know, a lot of people will discuss this whole issue of keynote prescribing. And I think that some people might level the criticism towards you that what you're doing here is essentially a type of keynote prescribing. And, you know, we kind of learn in our early days of homeopathic education that that's a no-no, and that's, you know, what the, you know, these homeopaths working in Calcutta with, you know, 100 patients a day have to do, where they just take a couple of symptoms and they prescribe upon them. And that's not really the most effective or deep-acting type of homeopathic practice to pursue. So I'm just curious how you would respond to such a criticism.
Okay, you know what? That's a fantastic case, because where I was about to go, which you with amazing wisdom have presaged, is this. You know, once after I presented this case, that's exactly what somebody said to me. They said, you know, the cases you presented were interesting, but you didn't present much in the way of deep information. And they said to me, do you really want to support this kind of, quote, keynote prescribing. Well, you couldn't have pressed a better button. But the situation is this. You know, it goes back to, again, our concept of what is homeopathy? What is keynote prescribing? What is the focus of our intention in case analysis? Now, keynote prescribing has been a derogatory term. Kim, what do you think it means?
Well, I mean, I think it has different definitions depending on which person you're reading it about, you know, because you can see, for example, Cantall was criticizing keynote prescribing and then always talking about keynotes of remedies. So I think it's interpreted differently, you know, from the way Guernsey originally used it to the way later time practitioners used it. But I've always kind of adhered to the definition that Dr. Hirsky uses. But I don't want to answer that because for me it's a very complex answer, so I'll let you go ahead and address what.
Well, you know, my interpretation, just I think the way that that it's leveled as an insult,
oh, yeah,
is that
sure.
You've made a prescription based on only one symptom without reference to the rest of the case. It's not the case here. And Guernsey in 1868, Guernsey gave us two articles explaining his intent in the keynote symptom. One in 1868, July, the other in 1871. And really, when you really look at the beautiful column or the beautiful description he gave us, he's only saying what Hahnemann said in Aphorism 153. He's only explaining to the idea of the keynote being the piece of the focus of a piece of music around the composition is built. But he never said to use a keynote out of context. Not at all. The keynote system is synonymous with the Hahnemannian system. And what is the Hahnemannian system? The Hahnemannian system, the beauty of Aphorism 153. I know we only have 5 minutes, so I'll abbreviate it as opposed to wanting to go on for 2 hours. But the beauty of the Hahnemannian system is this. The genius of Hahnemann is in recognizing that we identify a medicine the way we cognitively identify anything. We identify it immediately by its most peculiar aspects, supported by the rest of our perception, which says, oh yeah, you know what? That's Kim walking down the hall. I recognize the way he steps and his silhouette. Hahnemann understood that with a brilliance that's unsurpassed. Guernsey mirrored that in trying to identify it in his two articles on the keynote system, but immediately it became a derogatory term, and it is to this day, and completely without substantiation. Hahnemann wanted us to identify a remedy by its manifestations, its symptoms, and especially the ones that are most unique and then confirmed by the ones of lesser importance and uniqueness, so that we identify a remedy the way we identify our friends in the dark or in the light. This is misunderstood. Hahnemann wanted us to use only features of the disease of this individual, the way that they have changed since not been well, without embellishment, without any other ideas in the middle, but only the raw features of change. So if you're approaching a case saying, I need to find the essence, I need to find the delusion, I need to find this, that, you're not practicing original homeopathy. Original homeopathy is without a conceptual filter prior to looking at the raw features of the case. And the keynote method is consistent with that. Is that okay, Kim?
Yeah, that's great. Well, what a wonderful and very concise description of a sometimes very confused subject in homeopathic practice. And, you know, of course, I really appreciated what you said about it's really the one symptom is not an isolated phenomena, but it's really in the context of the rest. And that's, of course, what Hahnemann repeatedly says is when he uses the complex of symptoms, or what, you know, Stuart Close describes as, you know, the idea that these symptoms are all related to each other. So, yeah, I think that was a very, very nice definition of a very important aspect of homeopathic practice. I can see that we've only got about 2 minutes left. Let me open it up and see if there's maybe just one question that is burning on somebody's mind that they'd like to ask you, and we can let that happen. So hold on.
For sure.
So is there anybody who'd like to ask a question of Dr. Kellerstein?
Kim, I have a question.
Yes, who's calling? Who's asking?
This is Laura. Laura from
Facebook.
Dr. Kellerstein, I think you're brilliant. It's absolutely amazing what you've done, and your success absolutely brings forth everything that brings forth all your brilliance. But I have a question. Can you address dry dosing versus water dosing? I know the Organon 6 really was working on the water dosing, and where do you stand on this?
Kim, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear clearly.
I didn't hear it either. It's very hard to hear you. Can you try to repeat the question one more time?
I'll try. Maybe I should slow down. I was just saying, Dr. Kellerstein, that I think you're brilliant, and your success absolutely is profound. I mean, you're getting great, wonderful things going, and I'm wondering what your opinion is on dry dosing versus water dosing.
Okay, I got it that time. Did you hear it, Joe?
No.
Okay. Question was, what is your opinion on dry dosing versus wet dosing? So basically the difference between the fourth edition of the Organon and then the subsequent introduction of liquid potencies in the fifth and sixth editions.
Oh, thank you for those questions. I think that the liquid dosing introduces a kind of flexibility, but let me go a meta level above that. Guys, in terms of dosing, period, there is no religion, there is no mythology around dosing. As far as I'm concerned, the principal focus behind dosing is A, find something that works, guys. Second, keep it working however you can, and I'm happy. Now, if that means dry dosing or liquid dosing is perhaps more appropriate to people with greater environmental sensitivities, greater emotional lability, people whose disease state is more sensitive to violent fluctuation. But you know what? I don't care. Just find something that moves that case and then find a way to keep it moving. That's all I care about. No religion, no hanging on to, oh, we must dose this way, that way. I don't care. Find something that works, keep it working, push that patient to a cure, period.
All right, fantastic. So let me just remind everybody that Dr. Kellerstein will be one of the international presenters at this year's Joint American Homeopathic Conference in Alexandria, Virginia, April 8th through the 10th. This is going to be an amazing event, and Dr. Kellerstein is just one of a number of top-level, brilliant homeopathic practitioners and educators who will be in attendance, and there will even be an opportunity to see these individuals dialogue over various issues in homeopathic practice. A perfect example is the whole issue of dry dosing versus liquid dosing, which is, you know, many people have different opinions about this, and we'll be able to ask them questions directly and hear their different points of view and have a really interesting and civil dialogue and discussion about these critical issues in homeopathic practice. Also, Dr. Kellerstein is one of the core instructors at the newly named Canadian College of Homeopathic Medicine. If you want more information about his teaching there or the school itself, you can visit their website, www.homeopathycanada.com. If you want more information about the Joint Homeopathic American Homeopathic Conference, you can go to the NCH website. That's www.homeopathic.org. And you'll see the link there for the event page. And also, Joe, I know you're teaching your own course and also one with Dr. Andre Sain. Do you have any information about that or how people could get more information?
anybody who wants some information about that can call my office in Oshawa at area code 905-433-8666.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you again, Joe. It's been a great call, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in just a few weeks in Alexandria, Virginia. I'm going to open up the lines, and if everybody could give Dr. Kelsheen a warm North American thank you, I think that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Dr. Kelsheen.
All right, everyone. Have a very good evening, and look forward to seeing you all very soon. Take good care.
Have a good evening, all of you.